I first interviewed Molly Hatch on October 27th of 2013. I met Molly when she came to Anderson Ranch Art Center as a workshop scholarship recipient. During that two-week workshop, I remember being moved and intrigued by her ability to draw on the clay surface. I have enjoyed watching where Molly's career has gone. I take pleasure in knowing the woman behind the objects I see in the Twin Cities Anthropology Store. In my opinion, she is one of the most diversely creative women in both the contemporary ceramics and design fields. Her clay has never prevented her from moving into other areas of design, and likewise, those areas do not prevent her from being in ceramics. The daughter of a painter and an organic dairy farmer, her childhood was divided between physical labor, play, and creating art. Molly received her BFA at the Museum School in Boston and her MFA at the University of Colorado in Boulder. In 2009, she was awarded the prestigious Arts Industry Residency in the Pottery at the John Michael Kohler Art Center. Her works have been widely collected, commissioned, and exhibited both nationally and internationally. Her largest work to date is on permanent view at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta. Molly lives with her family in Northampton, Massachusetts, and is represented by Todd Merrill Studio Contemporary in NYC. I hope you enjoy our conversation. In reading the bio on your webpage, you talk about the experience you had at the John Michael Kohler Art Center as an artist in residence, and that laying the foundation for your career as an artist designer. Could you talk a little bit about what you worked on in the time that you were there and how that in that experience in general, and perhaps maybe touch on what parts of that experience really helped influence you?
I mean, it's interesting because I was pregnant during that time, during the time that I was there. And I had graduated from graduate school with my master's in 2008. And so I applied as I was finishing up my master's degree for the artist in residence there in the pottery, and I did it based on the sort of recommendation from Beth Lippman, who's a glass artist who was running the program at the time, and she came as a visiting artist while I was still in graduate school and was like, oh my god, you have to apply, you're such a good fit for this residency. And I think what was so effective for me was that I was able to spend time working with my artwork in a new way, with new materials, new process, and actually had sort of someone paying for my time to do it. And being exposed to the way industry worked there was the most influential for me, I think. Understanding that the laborers on the floor hand finish everything, and it was sort of like, wow, okay, so the Mr. Rogers understanding of what factory things are isn't exactly, it's not all machine finished, it's not all machine crafted, there's a person behind every object. And I think that that's shaped a lot of my willingness to work with industry in licensing and design since then, understanding the craft of the factory, kind of. Some people would disagree with me, but I definitely feel like took so much pride in what they did, and it was really obvious to me that those were crafted objects in the same way that someone would use, Nick Bivens would use a mold in his studio. These guys were using molds, but on a larger scale. And they were so interested in making everything work really well, and they were constantly reworking a mold to make it work better. I mean, it was just sort of amazing. It was like the same process that we would use, just on a factory scale of production. So I think when I talk about it influencing my career, that's what I mean. Like, it's sort of like this, it was like, it just completely opened my eyes to the possibility of what an artist could do in industry.
So I know in 2010, you were hired to create an exclusive line of pottery for Anthropology. Could you talk a bit about this endeavor and how did it come about, and what were some of the challenges you faced as a creator for that company?
It came about because one of their executives, a woman who runs their special projects, was named Patty Eisen, was in New York, and she saw my work in what was the former little shop at the Clay Studio, or the Greenwich House Pottery on Jones Street. They used to have pots in the window, and now it's their gallery is now on that first floor. And she saw the work and thought, oh, I need to get one of my tabletop buyers to see what she's doing and see if she'd be interested in collaborating. So they emailed me and essentially were interested at first in having me wholesale them some of my original work. And wholesale for me at that time, I was really starting to realize that my process was really involved. The work that I was making was far more time consuming than what people were willing to pay for it. It was already leading to I was making money on my work, which was really great, but making money meant paying taxes on $1,000 a year. it wasn't a living yet. And,
right.
And that was a problem. And I had a family at that point. So my daughter was, when they first contacted me in 2010, my daughter was 10 months old. And it's a really different set of motivations for making a living when you have a kid in the picture. You're willing to set aside some things that maybe you wouldn't have been willing to consider, you know, or setting aside in the past. And I don't feel that I did that in the end. I mean, at the time, it felt like a big, big decision, but I approached them to let me design some stuff because I felt like I'm not making money at this. Like, I want to try seeing what happens with the work when it translates into a factory made object. And they came back with inlaid pots and pieces that were made the same way that I would make them. They were hand painted and they were a fraction of the cost of what it cost me to make them, because they were making them on such a large scale and they were making them in a factory. So, you know, I went for it, and that led to, I've now been working with them for almost 4 years, and I've made over 250 objects with them, and they've supported my art career as well. But really, I mean, the major effect that that had was a large amount of money came in. Like, all of a sudden I was actually really making a living off of my pots. Like, my pots were still my pots. My process didn't change, and I was handing them prototypes and making pots, but just coming up with new ideas all the time, which is sort of like everyone's dream, right? I mean, right. At least from my perspective, I feel like I spent a lot of time in my studio repeating the same designs because that's what people wanted, and I was so ready to develop new ideas, and I felt like, you know, I couldn't afford to take the time to do that. And I feel like I've talked to a lot of other people who have that's the same conundrum, kind of. To be paid to properly for one design, to come up with a bunch of other designs, it's like, woo, you know, like, this is so cool. And then to be able to dream up what you would do with wallpaper and tabletop, you know, like, other things, it was sort of like my mind just went there. I'm a pattern and surface person, so I think that that's why it worked for me. Like, it's not for everybody. But that extra cash and that extra influx. I was working with Leslie Farron at the same time. Like, she had, her gallery was doing pretty well. She was looking for new artists, and she happened to be 20 minutes away from me here. She saw the work that I had done. The first time I hung out with Anthropology and they looked at my work in person was during a solo show that I had at the Clay Studio in Philadelphia in the spring of 2010. It was June of 2010, and Leslie saw that work happening in my studio. So they both picked me up kind of at the same time. And so all of a sudden I had, because I was getting paid well for the work that I was doing with Anthropology, I all of a sudden had money to invest in making more conceptual or installation type artwork for Leslie. And it was so exciting because I wouldn't have had the time and energy to do that, you know, maybe once a year. But then all of a sudden I had the money and then the time, I could buy the time to do that. And so pretty much like hand in hand, you know, the relationship with Leslie grew and she started taking me to art fairs and she was selling work. You know, she and I have since split and gone our separate ways, but, and I have a different gallery that I'm working with, but you know, I really don't think that I would have been able to pay attention to that part of my career the way I wanted to and needed to without having that support financially. I think the reason I got into pottery in the first place was because it was something that people can understand and approach. And I love the idea of drawings on pots pots as a way to sort of democratize drawing, for lack of a better description. So like by pulling it out of a frame and off the wall and putting it on something that you're intimate with, or you already understand, like I understand a cup, everyone understands a cup. So even if, you know, Joe Schmo doesn't understand why there's the drawing on the cup, he can still appreciate the value of its for use, its function. But when you're making $90 or $120 cups, like that kind of falls up to the wayside. longer, you know, and so I felt like the integrity of what I was doing was still there. Like the drawing, the concept, the idea just being executed by someone else. And there is a sort of weird disassociative thing that happens when you're like looking at cups that you feel are yours, but you didn't make them. There's like a detachment that's like bizarre. Like it's very strange. You got used to it really fast. I didn't have to make those hundreds of thousands, but like it was a good idea. And so, you know, I just could never have fulfilled that many orders on my own, like without like never wanting to make another mug again.
Or without a team of people, you know, doing yeah. parts of your process for you, even if it's loading a kiln, you know.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, there was a lot of value in it for me and for my ideas and the kind of work that I'm making. And like I said, it's not everyone's work would translate that way. And I felt like, well, you know, if the factory can do this, then what else can I do with that? Or can I start focusing on making pots that I wouldn't be able to afford to take the time to make? Like, so I designed things that like were like crazy cake stands that I never would have taken the time to do as a studio potter, because who's going to pay $2,000 for a cake stand? No one is going to do that. But you can afford to do that when industry is willing to pay you a licensing fee or a design fee that is the equivalent of that. You know, I mean, you can afford to take your time and make it really well, you know?
You mentioned the importance to you of life beyond the studio, which I think is a good thing for all of us to think about. How do you balance work and work life and family life? And what do you choose to do to recharge and live outside of that creative outbuilding you have?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love my garage where I am right now. I think having my daughter was a huge, there was like a real motivation to ground myself in the importance of the rest of the worlds, like beyond making work. Like I think I would be a total shut-in if I didn't have to go get my kid at the daycare, you know, have play dates with her friends. And I remember being very conscious of that at the time. Like my husband and I needed to have her. Like it was an important balancing step on our part. And it forced me to sort of reconcile and constantly forces me to like have to put things down at 5 o'clock, make dinner, take a run, go to the playground, do the things that I want to do. And it is also hard to explain to people who have 9-to-5 jobs that like what I like to do with a glass of wine at the end of the day is the same thing that I do all day. Like they're like, you go back to work after your kid goes to bed. Like, what is your problem? Like you work on the weekends? Like what? And it's like, it's work, but it's not work. And I like, you know, I kind of arrange it so that the things that I get to do in the evening, I can watch some TV while I'm doing it. Or, you know, I think it's a funny, it's hard to explain because I think on some level it's workaholism, but on another level it's like just a deep, deep passion for the things that I'm doing. And so I run and my husband and I bike and we like to ski and, you know, we have things that we do and cooking and we have a garden and a dog and our daughter. It's sort of just getting through the day to day of like maintaining our house and painting the walls and, you know, like doing the domestic things is the balance for me. Although I would love to see a little more time dedicated to that. That kind of ebbs and flows. It depends on the season, time of year, what's going on. But having daycare full time 5 days a week from 8:30 in the morning to 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon is that's how I have a career, basically. Like without that, I don't think, without that and my then, you know, having the studio out back with a monitor and her being able to go to bed at 8 o'clock or 8:30 and then me coming back out again for a few hours, that without those two things combined, I just wouldn't be getting anything done.
That's my next question. And that's, you know, I know your studio is an outbuilding at your house and yeah. What's the advantage and disadvantage of having that arrangement?
I don't feel like there's any disadvantage for me in how I operate at this point. And that's because I have a kid. I think if I didn't have a kid, then I think having a separate space might be healthier to like force me to come home for certain things at certain times. But I have my dog at work with me. I have ultimate control over the space. We bought this house with this space in mind in particular. And now I own it. Like, I can fuck up my career and I still have a studio. I can take more risks because I will still have a studio at the end of the day. If ultimately, the plan is to make work for the rest of my life, then whether I make money from it or not, you know, ultimately, of course, that would be amazing. But if I end up deciding to, or if things like the world stops liking my pots or something, you know, I can still make my work. I have this place to do that. And there's something, I remember realizing that and being like, oh my God, you know, like, that's amazing. Like, it's all paid for. I have a slab roller and I have the kilns and I have everything I need. And that no one's, unless we like can't pay our mortgage, no one's going to ever be able to take that away. Having it out back means that I have to walk, you know, a little few steps out of the house to go. And so there is this, forever it's been in the basement of my house or like the basement of some other building or what, I mean, the basement. For some reason, pop studios are in the basement. And in our previous rental, it was in the basement and it like flooded every day. But like just, I could hear my husband and my daughter upstairs walking around and it made me feel guilty for being in the studio. Just having the building be a separate building. It's a one car garage that we finished off. It's like 350 square feet. It's nothing huge, but it's separate. And it means that when I have a studio assistant, I have a woman who comes and works with me 2 days a week. And she, it's a separate building and, you know, she uses our bathroom and everything, but it feels like that's work. This is home, but I get to look out my window at the garden and, you know, my daughter comes home from school every day and knocks on the door and says, Mama, it's time to stop working. It's And I can have the monitor on while she's napping or while she's sleeping or, you know, and I kind of love, I have a sort of romantic notion of her being slightly more independent as a 7, 10, 14 year old and me being this fixture in the studio. Like, I'm always home. I'm always here. I will be here when she gets off the bus. I'll be here when she, you know, and there's this sort of lovely idea that I don't have to detach myself from that to participate in her life and she can kind of have her life around it. And see how hard I work and participate. I grew up on a farm in Vermont, and I think okay. that's sort of a similar experience. Like, my parents were around, but they were working their asses off, and I was around, and I was quite independent, but I could see how dedicated they were to what they were doing, and I got to participate, too. She has, like, a little desk that she can work at in my studio, and I definitely include her in that space, too. So there's a major advantage. I mean, I suppose the disadvantage is that I get interrupted sometimes because I'm right here. So my husband might come out and be like, you know, like, what are you cooking for dinner? I'm like, go away, I'm working. Like, I know it doesn't look like it, but I'm working. I can get interrupted a lot more that way. But I can also run in and throw laundry in at lunch. And, you know, so it's sort of like, you know.
Okay, so I want to go back in time to those first days, weeks, or months after the birth of your daughter. Can you talk a bit about how much time you took away from the studio at that point in time and your feeling about that separation from the studio? Or maybe you didn't have it at all. And when did you dive back into your studio practice?
So I had my daughter a little early. I ended up having preeclampsia, which was sort of an odd presenting itself oddly. So I ended up being quite sick. The recovery from preeclampsia can be really rough. And for me, it wasn't too bad, but I was just really exhausted. I was really, really tired going into it. I mean, I know a lot of parents since who that first month after having a baby, they're like, oh, this is fine. You know, like, I can handle this. And you're like, here, wait for it. I was like that from day one. Like, I just was so exhausted. We were in an interesting situation. I graduated in 2008 with a crash of the economy, and I was working towards, you know, I had a rental studio for a little bit when we first moved to Northampton area where we live now, when I was still pregnant with my daughter, around 6 months pregnant, and we got an apartment and that had a studio in it. So we had to move into the studio. And so I set it up sort of intentionally knowing that like I was going to need to be working from home because I had a kid, but we were living off of my husband's income as a builder, which was like maybe 35 or 40,000 a year for the two of us. So we were on welfare. We had WIC. We didn't qualify for food stamps by like $300 a month or something. It was like painful. We were so close. I mean, it was almost worth Oliver taking a pay cut just to be eligible for it. But so we had to kind of, I got really creative. The way I earned money was doing childcare, staying home, making food, preserving food. My parents had to have an amazing garden, and so we would go and pick vegetables and put them away in our freezer. And we used WIC to, you know, like we eked that out, and we were really living on a shoestring completely. We owned our vehicles outright. They were old, but we kind of struggled. You know, it was really kind of nuts. Like the difference between my lifestyle now and 5 years ago is really crazy. That first couple months, so I had my studio, but it wasn't really very well put together. It was sort of set up in the basement of this rental property that we had, and I had one of my kilns there and everything, but it was close and it was home, so I could kind of dabble down there. But I didn't really get down there until my daughter was about 2 months old. I started working again because I had to. I had a show, like I'd sort of stupidly set up a show for myself at the Bennington Art Museum in Bennington, Vermont. I had a solo there, and I was going to make all new work for it. And I had to start in on it, like, you know, when she was 2 months old to get it done, like for three or four months later. My mom, having my mom nearby was really helpful. My mother-in-law lives 15 minutes away, but she just wasn't capable of it. Like, she just couldn't quite be part of it. My mom was, in addition to being a farmer, was a painter. So she knew what it was going to take for me. Like she felt like if I took too long of a break from the studio, that I was going to not, it would be tempting not to go back to it or to prioritize other things. And she really wanted me to be able to continue the studio practice. And I was one of those moms that had a really hard time. Like, I would admire these friends of mine who were like, I left my baby with my friend for 2 hours and I went off shopping. And I was just, like, horrified. Like, I couldn't have done that. Like, I was so attached to her. And I was so worried about her. Like, my anxiety levels were, like, through the roof. But I felt comfortable leaving with her with my mom. And at that time, having my studio in the house felt really good because I could hear when she was crying a certain way, or I could hear where my mom was, or, you know, what was going on, and I'd run up and sort of try to breastfeed her in the middle of, you know, trying to make, it was nuts. Like, it was totally crazy that I was, that show kind of came off, like I managed to make the show happen, but it was definitely a little nuts. I was pushing the envelope, I think, but I owe it all to my mom because I didn't have childcare. I couldn't afford it. And she came down once a week. And so I would go into the studio one day a week and I'd be working on this work. I finally kind of started to feel, after my mom coming down once a week and helping me with laundry and helping me with Camilla, my daughter, I finally felt around 6 months that it was time to have someone else come in a few days a week and help me out. So I hired a local grad student to come 2 or 3 days a week for 3 or 4 hours in the morning, and I would go down to the studio for like a half a day, and I paid her like some exorbitant amount of money. Like, she totally hosed me. Like, it was like 15 an hour or something for her to watch my daughter three hours at a time. And my daughter started taking formula from her, which was really helpful too, because I wouldn't have to interrupt what I was doing, and she would just sit there and play with her and kind of hang out. And it was really great. Like, she was an awesome person. I met her through care.com, which was really helpful. That sort of quickly grew into, like, I'd ask her for a little more time, and then I had my mom coming one day a week. And so I quickly, like, started to amp up what I was doing in the studio. And then around that same time, around 6 months, I visited Carrie Radash and Ian Anderson, and they had Ruby, their oldest daughter, around the same time, like a few months before I had Camilla. I remember very distinctly because they invited me to come lecture at Mecca at the Maine College of Art. I remember staying with them, and, you know, we were sort of reuniting, and it was cute, and the babies are, you know, and then the babies went to bed, and then Carrie's like, all right, I'm going to the studio. And I was like, it's like 9 o'clock. Like, aren't you exhausted? Don't you want to go to bed? And she was like, I'm going to the studio. She grabbed a beer, went to the studio, and started working. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, if I'm going to make this work, I've got to take advantage of every single minute I can and, like, push myself to get, like, even though I'm super exhausted, I have to use that time and nap during the day when I don't have childcare or whatever, like, just figure it out. And so as soon as I got home, I started doing the same thing. And it was like, oh my, it was like opened up this whole evening time. Like I was not used to working at night before. Yep. I was like a daytime person.
And did you find, I mean, because this is one thing I think that's kind of interesting. Did you find that once you had your daughter and you were back in the studio and maybe you only had an hour and a half of time, that you were more effective with that hour and a half than you were prior to her birth at all? Or did it not change for you?
I might have been more effective, but I think what I just got good at was like putting shit down. Like I got really good at like interrupting my ideas and my thought process. And I really think it has completely changed my entire process to where something was maybe perhaps a slightly more intuitive process earlier. I could take the time to just sit and develop a whole idea on the wheel and like sort of make a new pot form just by playing around. I had to sit down and do the research beforehand and then execute it because I didn't have time to fuck around. Like I had to like, you know, just make it happen and move through it and move on to the next thing because it was just, there was no time to guess or to not be decisive about it so that I could come back like after putting it down for an hour and like pick up where I left off and have a plan. Because sometimes the surfaces of what I'm doing, you know, like you can't, you have to know where you left. You can't leave off or, you know, I remember times like distinctively hearing Camilla crying and being like, I just have to draw this one last line. I don't, you know, like not gonna, wiping pots furiously, and, you know, late at night. And often the thing that would stop my evening sessions would be her waking up for a feeding at like 10 or 10:30 or something. And then I was like, all right, I'm done. Like I have to go to bed. But that slowly went away. And then, you know, she started sleeping through it, but she didn't start sleeping through the night properly until like a year ago, at like 3. It was horrible. But the real significant studio shift for me, like, so I was making it into the studio and I was getting time. I was probably getting in the equivalent of 3 days a week, like 3 full days a week of work. But, I got offered a teaching job at the local community college, at Holyoke Community College, teaching one class a semester, which quickly turned into 2 or 3 classes a semester. And it was like $7,500 for the semester. It was really good pay for adjunct. That's not good pay, but it's good pay for adjunct work. All of a sudden, I was like, wait, I have to have childcare. Like, she was a year old. And I was going to have to hand her off to someone, and I had to figure it out. And even if, but what I quickly realized was two full days of teaching at HCC meant that I had to meet the 3-day minimum at a daycare. That meant that I was paying for 3 full days of, you know, and it would more than pay for the daycare. So I was coming out on top and I could afford daycare all of a sudden. And that 3 days a week really quickly turned into 4, which really quickly turned into 5. You know, by the time she was 2, she was full-time, 5 days a week, 8:30 to 4:30 at a small private preschool here. And it was, like, amazing. Like, it just that, and learning to just drop her off. And I would run her there in the morning. It was close, so I got my exercise in. And then I would, you know, like, run there to get her in the afternoon. And it was, like, great. I was in good shape. I was in probably better shape than I am now. you know, and I had time in the studio, and it was like that just blew things open. And so, and at that point, I was already working for Anthropology, and so there was need and demand for more. I was pretty apprehensive about daycare at first, but man, that thank God for that teaching job in when she was a year old, because
you answered my next question, which was to talk a little bit about that cost benefit analysis of, yeah, you know, paying for childcare so that you can have the time, you know, it's both financial pay. And then I think sometimes there's guilt too. Like,
absolutely.
I'm taking my kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think everybody's felt it. I'm taking my kid and somebody else is going to take care of her so that I can go to my studio essentially, which is the work we need to be doing for ourselves and for our careers. But there's this kind of guilt feeling. And I don't know why it's any different than if I went to a business, you know?
Right. Don't you think that the difference is that it's not a money-making venture ultimately? Like, that was the thing for me. It was like,
yep,
this isn't paying the bills. Like, I'm paying taxes on $1,000 worth of income at the end of the day. But what it did do was, like, if I hadn't been doing that, and there had been a 2-year or 3-year gap in my
yes.
career, I'd be starting all
over again.
Now.
Yep.
And I could see that I couldn't afford to do that. Leslie wasn't going to wait for me, and neither was anthropology. Like, it was too valuable of a thing to put down. So even though, yeah, I mean, it was definitely, like, we were on welfare. It was sort of like this bizarre thing of having to figure out, like, you know, is this a long-term investment, basically? Like, I could have been teaching, and I could still be teaching. Like, I would be teaching there. Like, if I had stayed on, I would, the way that position happened to evolve, I would have been teaching 3 classes a semester, and I'd be making probably $30,000 a year teaching, you know, and that's okay. But thank God I didn't, because now it's like I'm making more than double that just doing what I'm doing, you know, with the way things have progressed. So I cannot wait for the $1,200 a month back, which is more than our mortgage next year when she goes to kindergarten, because I feel like we're going to actually be able to start putting money into, like, retirement. Like, what?
Yeah.
Like, who does that? But I think, you know, in the beginning, there was definitely this, like, guilty thinking, especially because my mom was of a generation, I feel like their whole generation was very anti-daycare. And she was like, what, you're going to let someone else raise your kid? And I was like, yeah, I am, actually, because I can't afford not to. I think I would have felt far more justified if I was pulling in enough money to pay for that and then bring home money to add to our daily income. And I had to start to break down the cost effectiveness of doing it in a slightly stranger way. So because we had our studio in house, my studio was in the house where we were living, I paid for a significant portion of our rent out of my studio budget. I paid for an enormous amount of our utilities because the studio ate up electric, you know, by like crazy because of the kilns. Phone costs. A lot of the travel costs, because every time I would go pick up my daughter, I'd be shipping a box. So part of the car costs, you know, I mean, it's sort of like if you started to add all of that up, I was like heavily subsidizing our income, but it was all tax deductible.
Yep.
So, and then I was paying for childcare on top of that. So at the end of the day, like if you started to take all that away and I was just staying home working with my being the mom and doing laundry and making our life more here I'm being interrupted. Hi, I'm on Skype call.
Okay. I'm gonna go out.
Okay. There you go, there it is. Hi. Hi Dean. bye. Figuring that out made me realize, okay, so there is more to it than just this sort of cash in, cash out. So maybe I wasn't paying our rent, but I was still contributing enough that it was like, if I wasn't working, it would have made a pretty significant difference in our day-to-day lives. And also then there's that sort of mental sanity part, like, how do you value that? I don't know, like, I needed to have something else other than my daughter. And I expected myself to be this mother that was like, I love babies. I'm going to have a million of them. And I was like really ready to be like that mom. And I totally wasn't. I was like, oh my God, I need a break. Like I resented her sometimes. Like I wanted more time than I was getting. And getting through that first couple of years and getting her into a place. I mean, she loved the daycare she was at too. It was sort of ironic. Like she would be like, bye. Like she would never have.
Yeah.
These,
we
like,
had the same experience. Our daughter went running in and just like didn't look back, or we've gone to pick her up before and she's in the middle of playing and she'll come over and hand you a toy and then go back and keep playing.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's always kind of, in some ways it's kind of feels good because then I think it takes away some of that guilt of feeling like, you know, you've left her someplace, you know?
Right.
And actually they do enjoy it.
Yeah. And I think they need it. The social thing. But yeah, I mean, it takes a long time to get over that. Like, I feel like I should be this parent who wants to stay home with my kids. But I've also watched friends of mine who have done that and I feel like they're lost. Like they don't really know who they are aside from being a parent. And I think it's really valuable for kids to see that you have other things going on. I was really driven to get back into the studio, and if I hadn't been, I wouldn't be here. And it was really important to me to make sure my work happened. And I think, you know, I can see pretty easily how, like, if you weren't that committed to what you're doing, it'd be pretty quick to fall to the wayside and lose yourself in parenting or another job to support yourself. Or, you know, I mean, I'm very lucky that I had a husband who was okay with that. Like, it takes a particular person to support to that degree, like the willingness to live. I mean, if I had been making as much money as he was, we would have been living just fine for a long time. And I really wasn't making that money. You know, I was not making much at all. But he saw the long-term benefit of it, potentially. But it's all the more reason to make, like, so that was the other thing. I mean, it's like, if I'm going to pay for my daughter to go to daycare 5 days a week or, you know, even 3 days a week, I'm going to make the best, you know, make the most out of what I'm doing in that time. Like, I would feel guilty earlier on. I don't anymore, but earlier on, I would feel guilty, like, when I drop her off to daycare and, like, run an errand because I felt like I just needed it to be easier to do it without her. Or I would actually, like, go, like, do something just for me. Occasionally, I would, like, use that time to go to do something just for me, and it was, or, like, go get my nails done or something, like, whatever. I don't even know what I would do. The times, like, go shopping at the bookstore, like, doing a couple times, but I remember feeling like horrified. And in the end, like, I think it's, you need just as much of a balance of, like, time for yourself for whatever reason, whatever it is you want to do, and work time in the studio too. You know, yeah, the guilt thing, I don't know where it comes from, whether it's society or some other, like, the other moms who are staying home who feel like you should be too, or, like, I have no idea, but I definitely felt the same thing.
What advice do you have for women who are working in the ceramics field as they begin to think about, or not, you know, because I think some people don't think about it at all, about their futures as mothers and makers?
I think anyone who's interested in having children should just go for it, and you'll figure out how to make it. I watched Carrie Radosh, who was far more established in her career than I was, we were pregnant at the same time, have to relearn how to have her studio practice happen, and she did a really good job of it. But I felt like in my own studio practice, the timing was, like, right after graduate school, and I had to sort of, my career has grown with my daughter at the same time, and so I've had to figure it out with her there the whole time, pretty much. I mean, not to say that I didn't have a career before graduate school or during graduate school, but really the career with the focus that I've had on it now has been there with a kid on alongside that. And I think it would have been really challenging for me to try to figure that out after, like, if I had a kid right now. Without having had a kid, I would be so much more entrenched in what I was used to doing and the money I was used to having or not having. I didn't have any money and I didn't have any time. And I was like, you know, having a kid at that point was a really good move on our part, though I'm not sure I could have predicted when that would have been good. Otherwise, I mean, it's just like there's no good time or bad time. Like, maybe there are bad times, but it's been really valuable for me to have her. But I'm not having any more either. Like, that's one is more than, like, I feel like my career is another child. It demands as much time as, or more as her, and her needs. It's slightly different, obviously, but it definitely feels like having another kid, I'm not sure where there would be room for all that to happen for a while. And I'm not really willing to make that concession. So I do think too, like, recognizing, you know, having the studio and home if you can, and being able to divide your time between, you know, what you're doing and your kid, and in having the access, easy access to coming and going, has been really helpful for me, or being able to bring some of it home with you.
Are there other women who are working in clay that are also mothers that you feel are role models? And what have you gained from these ladies?
Kim Dickey, who is one of my graduate thesis faculty at CU, had young children when I was there. And she definitely sort of set an example, or set the bar high for managing a career with kids and an artistic career with kids and a job teaching. Like, I couldn't believe what she was able to accomplish. And again, I think I saw the support in her husband. That was really huge. That was like a huge part of how she was able to do it. So I think Kim is someone I've looked at, and Carrie. There are other folks, but those two, I would say, are the two that I have looked to the most, who have made decisions that have, or set patterns in their own studio practices or lives that I was kind of like, okay, like, I can do this, or this is possible. And then my own mom, like, she's had a studio practice her whole life. Maybe not a showing career in the traditional sense. The fact that she's continued to make work for her whole life, you know, she's managed to find time. And I think that consistency and willingness to devote herself to it, like, I think that's an incredible example.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation. For more information or to listen to additional interviews like the one you just heard, please visit www.bothartistandmother.com. Funding for this project was made possible by St. Olaf College's Academic Innovation Fund. Special thanks to Caleb Genheimer for his audio editing, the Ericsons for their music, Heather Wang for her transcription skills, Rachel Elizabeth Murphy for her web expertise, and to all the artist mothers. Thank you.